welcome to another episode of GT Radio. I'm Tino Magnetta. Well, it's not just another episode of GT Radio. It's the 175th episode of GT Radio. And can you imagine, we've done 175 episodes. And it's the first episode of 2020. I'm so excited to have Casey Cohen with us. He's the Chief Marketing Officer of the Hippodrome Casino in London. Casey, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Tino. Thanks for inviting me, and Happy New Year.
Great, man, and I'm so glad you're the first interview of the year, because there's been so much happened this year. But it's funny how we met, because we had met once at a conference, and then I did this one minute video clips of GMs and CEOs and marketing guys, and I was doing Mike Donovan. I was doing a Mike's a great guy. I love the guy. I call him the magician. He turns casinos around. And you were there, and then you got roped in to do an interview, right?
I did. You asked me if I wanted to say something, and I said, sure, I'll say something. Happy to talk about the Hippodrome. It's one of my favorite subjects.
Well, you know, let's talk about that briefly, and then we'll parlay into 2020. Tell everybody. I mean, people don't really know, that's like a huge casino, and it's got a big story behind it. Tell us a little bit about it, because a lot of people don't know what it is.
Sure. So the Hippodrome Casino opened in the early 1900s as a theater, and it stayed as a theater for close to 75 years, I believe. It had the likes of Judy Garland perform there. In fact, some of the movie is set in the Hippodrome, the recent movie that won the Golden Globe, and some other famous folks who aren't coming to mind at the moment have performed there. But it then became a nightclub and closed, I believe, in 2000. So it was the Hippodrome Theater, then the Hippodrome Nightclub, and then in 2006 and 2007, Simon Thomas and Jimmy Thomas, the owners of the Hippodrome, took over the property as a casino, or I should say, evolved it into a casino, and were able to build it out. And we opened up in 2012, and it's unlike any other casino in London, because as many people who've never been to the UK, and if you have been to the UK, if you haven't seen a casino in the UK. The perception of them are still sometimes that we require membership at the casinos in London and in England, and that's just not the truth anymore. They changed that in 2005 with the new UK Gaming Act, and now casinos are open to anyone. They're not as stodgy. They're not as James Bond. You don't need to have a tuxedo on, and you don't need to wait 24 hours to be admitted, and Jimmy and Simon had a vision to create something that was as integrated as you see here in the States, with restaurants and table games and slot machines, as well as a theater, all in one massive building. And they've been quite successful at it. We've got about 90 table games, about 85,000 square feet of space. Although they talk about it in square meters, and I'm not the best at converting that statistic, but we also have about 300, maybe it's closer to 200 slot machines. Now, the UK is more of a table-centric market, so and regulatory environment doesn't allow as many slot machines as we're accustomed to here in the States. But I think early on they were operating in silos of each other. So food and beverage was the offering, separate from the theater offering, separate from the casino offering. And they really wanted to further integrate that in their marketing initiatives and efforts and strategies. And we were able to achieve that by way of some of the philosophies and practices that we put into place here in the States, with things like a meaningful loyalty club, some unique brand messaging that has now come out of the property, including a nod to the history of the property and ensuring that everybody understands what the experience will look like when they come in, and that it's a safe place for them to be and an enjoyable place for them to be at that. So yeah, it's been a really interesting experience for me as someone who has operated in mostly only American casinos with a short year at the Atlantis in the Bahamas. But it's been a really interesting experience for me to see how it once was and how it is now in London. And by the way, just an amazing city with a rich history, as everybody knows. Really just a fun part of my career. I hope it continues for a long time to come.
Yeah, London's an extraordinary city. It's one of those cities that's, you know, up there with the great cities of the world, like New York and L.A. and all the great cities. Give us a little bit of a feel, because gambling has been part of integrated into the culture there, because you have a lot of sports betting everywhere. It's like liquor stores everywhere, right? Tell us how gambling is perceived in Britain and how it's very different, and what you saw as the stark differences, so that our audience gets a feel of what it's like over there with gambling.
So incredibly, and we know all of these operators that operate sports books. So many of them here are operating now in the casinos in the U.S., but there's betting shops on many corners and storefronts where you could go in and place a bet on your favorite European soccer team or your favorite sporting event, cricket, whatever it may be. You can even bet on American football now over there. Well, always received, and everybody's happy to participate in that. And the lottery, people are happy to participate in that as well. I think that from the change to the 2005 Gaming Act, that prior to that, you know, you needed a membership to walk into a bricks and mortar casino that offered table games and slots. Some folks felt a little intimidated to frequent casinos in the UK, and they were very small. There wasn't as much hustle and bustle because of that to the casinos, is my perception and my understanding. That perception needed to change, and I believe that it has. There's some properties outside of London, in Birmingham to be exact, that look more like what we see in the U.S. with a hotel on top of them and spa and all kinds of retail amenities, that I think has helped educate the population around what a gaming experience could look like from the standpoint of how you could enjoy your time doing things besides just gaming. But there is no other property that offers it in my mind in an integrated fashion like the Hippodrome does, in the center of it all. You know, Birmingham's at least an hour and a half train ride from London, and not to continue to compare the two, but the Hippodrome sits in the middle of Leicester Square, steps away from the National Gallery, about a half mile from Buckingham Palace and Parliament. And there's, I believe, roughly 100,000 people walking by it a day. It's got foot traffic that would make even the best marketers in Las Vegas blush. So it's an incredible property, and it's not about having people look in and be intimidated to come in. It's an inviting atmosphere, and I think that cultural shift has changed since the Gaming Act change in 2005, and now we're doing things, and we have queues outside the door for people to come in to see, believe it or not, the NFL, to watch any European football or soccer matches, and people understand that there's more to do than just go head up to a blackjack table or a slot table, a slot machine. Not that by any means there's, you know, something to be, that's something negative, but for a time it was a little bit intimidating, I think, for that population. So I would say that would be the most stark comparison and mostly the extreme. I believe that the greater population was quite comfortable with it even before that, but it came down to some of those outliers that were certainly wondering, is it okay to go in? And I think that the properties like the one I mentioned in Birmingham, which is a Genting property, and the Hippodrome are leaders that changed that mindset in the UK.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable place, and I know that the casino that you that you're at is also a very, it's got just an amazing history, just amazing colorful history. So let's talk a little bit about 2020. 2020 is shaping up to be a pretty incredible year, but 2019 seems to be where all the triggers were pulled. You had the takeover of Eldorado, of Caesars. You had all the consolidation of all the game manufacturers. You had all the major expansions of all the Indian casinos. And it goes on and on. There were also all sorts of other consolidations with Penn and all the other game, you know, big players. What is going on? Where are we headed in 2020?
Oh, gosh. I wish I had a crystal ball to answer that one, but I think, Tino, that that die is somewhat cast. You can see that, just like you said, the El Dorado Caesars merger will continue, and I think that they've been selling off some one-off assets to satisfy some of the regulatory bodies around the country. And you'll start to see some opportunities for some of these smaller companies to buy up some of those assets. And that'll create some amazing opportunity, right? Not only for executives that maybe are thinking about changing, but also for customers. It's going to create an interesting level of competition once again in the industry, which is, favorable to the customer. And I think that that's the direction that the industry is taking. I think, to your point, when you look at a city like Las Vegas, the north side of the Strip continues to develop, and that's going to be meaningful as well. I think that's the 1 year 2020 outlook, is that this industry will continue to expand and offer new and unique reasons that we have to be on top of our game at all times, so that we can be the buying choice for the customer. And that's only favorable to the customer. So I think we're going to be, continued enjoyed experience throughout the country.
Yeah, I think it's all heading in the right direction. It's interesting to note about our business, about the resilience and how our business evolves it really quickly. But in the last 3 or 4 years, I felt that there's been a renaissance. You think that's going to continue?
The past 3 or 4 years, there's been a renaissance in gaming?
Yeah, like there's been an explosion.
I would agree with that. I think
consolidation, expansions, just the amount of money that's come into, and also in entertainment, the Las Vegas Knights, the football team coming into Vegas.
Yeah,
it all seems.
Yeah,
to
I think
happening.
That's very true for the city. And obviously gaming is bigger than just Las Vegas. And I do agree with you that our as the economy has recovered from 2008 and 2009, that so has gone the industry, and I think that more unique things have happened in Las Vegas, and I think a lot of unique things have happened in London, and I think a lot of unique things have happened around the country. If you just look at, I was talking to a friend earlier tonight from Seminole, and what they've done with that hotel in southern Florida, the business is just booming there. There's all kinds of capital going to the industry because people recognize that it's a viable industry, and investors want to place their money there. I mean, I real estate is part and parcel of it, but the operations and the uniqueness of our industry continues to be compelling. And I think if you look at so many properties around the industry, whether it's something like the Hippodrome, where they're doing something that's unique in their marketplace, something like the Seminole Tribe that are doing things that are unique in their marketplace, and my previous employer at the Cosmopolitan, it's one of the most unique properties on the Strip. There's reasons, more and more reasons, to visit markets like that and properties like that because of the things that the teams do and the way that they create amazing experiences for their guests.
Yeah, it's all about the experiences, no question about it. Tell me a little bit about your background. You were born in Salem, Pennsylvania, right?
I was born in the city in which another unique experience happens. I was born in the city I was born and raised in Philadelphia, but I grew up in the city that Parks resides in. So I remember Parks Casino when it was called Keystone Racetrack. I remember Parks Casino when it was called Philadelphia Park. And my grandfather, when I was 12 years old, used to pick me up from the house I was growing up in, tell my mom he was taking me shopping at the mall, and we'd wind up somehow at the track, and I would be picking horses. I'd get some popcorn, and he'd just ask me to pick some numbers. Whether I won or not, I don't remember. And if I did, I'm not sure that I really knew.
How old were you?
At that time, I was 12, and I'm sure I wasn't supposed to be there because after my grandfather passed away when I was 15, I tried to get back in. They wouldn't let me in. But for some reason, because I was with Hesh Cohen, I was apparently allowed in.
That's great. I love it. That's fantastic. Talk about getting the bug early. Oh, man.
Yeah, well, that's where it all fantastic. Came from, I think. I think I really enjoyed that.
I'm
ultimately,
sure.
I wound up when I was 15 working at a Holiday Inn right down the street. I needed a summer job, I guess it would have been, because my mother probably wouldn't have paid for my car insurance. And I was a bellman at this Holiday Inn. Now, as you can imagine, at the Holiday Inn, there wasn't much need for bell service, but somehow I wanted to make more tips than the average bellman. So I was pretty aggressive about opening up the trunk, pulling out the one carry-on bag the guy had in his rental car, and welcoming him to the Holiday Inn Bucks County. And he felt obligated to give me a couple bucks just for being a nice guy and maybe getting him ice. And I realized there's something to creating a sense of arrivalism or a sense of welcoming. And I think that's where I really grasped an understanding of the hospitality business. And then when you marry that up with spending time at Parks, Philadelphia Park, with my grandfather, it was only natural that after I left college, I found myself in Atlantic City.
Tell us a little bit about what your parents were like.
Sure. So my mother was she grew up in Atlantic City. She moved up to Philadelphia to work for industry. She was the office manager for a periodontist practice in downtown Philadelphia. Before he had his practice, the doctor was actually the assistant dean at Penn Dental, University of Pennsylvania Dental School. And she worked there until she retired. My father was more of a go-getter. He was a salesperson. And I remember watching my dad never be afraid to pick up the phone, call someone, introduce himself, and ask them if he could just drop his business card in the mail to them so that when they're thinking about buying whatever product he might have been selling at that time, because it was for a variety of different companies and whatnot, he was happy to put himself out there. So that ability or that level of confidence, I think, is something that I took with me when I became a player development person later in my career as well. There's no person you can't call to say hello to. If they don't want to speak to you, they could always hang up. And I'm pretty sure that I got hung up on as many times as he probably was hung up on. But my dad was more of a, for lack of a better term, he was a hustler. He would get out there and get and put himself out there and really try to capture whatever sale he could capture. And I think in some ways that was probably spurned by his father, my grandfather that I mentioned, who owned a used furniture store in West Philadelphia. They were always that used furniture store lasted forever. But so that's a little bit of my family history. I've got two great parents that have kind of unique separate backgrounds. While my mom was more of a technical, go to work 9 to 5 every day, my father was more of a go-getter. So I learned a little bit of discipline and I learned a little bit of courage from the two of them combined.
So after you worked at the Holiday Inn at 15, you said, right? You got that job at the Holiday Inn?
Yes, let's go with 15. I'm not quite in my teens anymore. I'm not in my 20s or 30s, and we'll leave it at that. So I believe it was about 15 years old.
What was that like? Tell us a little bit about
my time at the Holiday Inn. That's where I learned that I wanted to be in the hotel business. And I thought it was just the hotel business. I was a bellman. I then worked my way up and became a front desk clerk. And I understood what it meant to yield manage hotel rooms. I understood how to revenue manage hotel rooms. A nod to my good friend Colleen Birch, one of the best revenue managers and revenue executives in the industry.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
She's been a guest on our show too.
I know she has, with Suzanne Trout, nonetheless, I believe.
Absolutely.
But
they both.
Yeah, so that was that's how I learned the hotel business. I was a night auditor there, and I remember I grew so interested in it that I'd sit around and wait to see if that one last person would come in or if we had to walk them. And I really grasped an understanding of what the business was about. And it was just at a small 308 room Holiday Inn. It's still one of my favorite hotels. It's a cool place to visit when I go back. I really learned a lot there. I wound up going to a school in the south of Philadelphia called Widener University for hotel restaurant management. Left Widener, I think in 94, and wound up deciding, do I want to go to New York City and put in applications in New York City where all the big hotels are, or do I want to go down to see my maternal grandparents in Atlantic City and put in a few applications there? So I couldn't figure out how I was going to afford a room overnight to apply at a bunch of hotels in New York City. So I wound up driving down to Atlantic City and putting in a bunch of applications, walking down the boardwalk on a rainy day. And back then there was no websites to apply online. You had to go to the employment center. And the first job I could find at one of the properties, it was the Atlantic City Hilton, the original Golden Nugget in Atlantic City, was PBX supervisor. So I was a supervisor of the PBX department. You pick up the phone, dial the operator, and you'd get me or somebody that worked with me at an original Steve Wynn property. And I believe that the Wynn organization still takes their centralized calling organizations and departments pretty seriously. And they took it pretty seriously back then too. quick story. On Sundays, I had to work, and I always wanted to watch the Eagles. I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan. Go Birds. Steve Whiteside, the VP of Hotel Ops, came down while I was watching them on this small TV and answering phones. And he told me that I wasn't allowed to watch TV while answering phones because I couldn't focus on answering phones. It took me a couple days, and I didn't know whether I was going to quit or whether I was going to be able to watch the Eagles game the next Sunday. And I asked them if I could announce the halftime and end-of-game scores over the PA system, because back then the idea of the crawl down the bottom of the TV screen was just starting, you know, the crawl of the scores of the updates of the games.
Yeah.
And I guess people took a liking to that because he let me watch the Eagles game. I would watch the crawl, and as the scores would come across, I would write them down and then announce halftime scores
and
end of game scores over the casino floor. And apparently that drew an interesting crowd of people to the Atlantic City Hilton, or attracted more people to the casino floor, because although sports betting now is quite legal in New Jersey, I'm not sure I'm sure it wasn't legal back then, but I'm quite sure many people had bets on some of their favorite sports teams back then, and were mostly interested in playing craps and keeping an update on whatever their bet was doing with their favorite their favorite bookmaker.
Yeah. And then after that, you became a junior casino host, right?
After that, yes. I think that that idea and the idea of me announcing those scores over the PA system was something that the vice president of marketing at the Atlantic City Hilton thought was a cool idea. Thanks for sparing me off there, Tino. He came down, and I think 1 week I either didn't announce a halftime score or maybe forgot an end of game score, and he came down and asked me why I didn't announce the score, and he said to me, "Are you the guy that's announcing the scores?" Yes, I am. And he said, "Can you announce the score of the game?" And he said, "Whose idea was this?" And I said, "Well, it's mine." And I thought I was in trouble, and the season ended, and somebody that is still in my life and one of my favorite people, his name's Lenny Ratasky, he's a host at the Cromwell these days, actually, asked me if I wanted to become a junior casino host. And I became a junior casino host at the Atlantic City Hilton, and my comp authority as a junior casino host consisted of one to the buffet. If I needed a authority for a second person to comp at the buffet, either had to have their own separate card or I had to call a higher host to get authority for it.
That's funny.
That's how I learned.
You thought you were in trouble. The guy's like, who's doing that? Are you the guy who's doing that? All right. You want to be a host? You saw the talent.
The story of my life. I always think I'm in trouble.
Yeah. Okay, so where does Wally Bard fit in?
I don't know. Wally Bard was the CEO of the company back
guy,
then.
Right?
It was a Park Place Entertainment property. I'd say that's how he fits in. For me, I was probably two small potatoes for Mr. Bard at that time, but I enjoyed watching what him and Arthur Goldberg did around marrying up the Hilton properties with the hotels and then separating that out again and acquiring Caesars Entertainment.
They were kind of like the first guys who went in and did that kind of stuff in Vegas, right?
M&A stuff? It sure seems like that for me, but I'm also kind of – I like to give a nod to the fact that I don't know too much about what happened before I showed up. But yes, it's, you know, the M&A stuff seems like it, It really started because it was everybody building their own hotels, owning them and operating them in perpetuity.
Yeah, on their
and
own.
And thereafter,
yeah.
That was it. But Arthur Goldberg wound up acquiring Caesars Entertainment as the CEO of Park Place. And
yeah.
I had left, actually, the Atlantic City Hilton after junior host. I became a casino host, and then I wound up at Harrah's Atlantic City for about 10 months and was then called back by the guys, the VP of marketing for Caesars World, and they wanted to know if I wanted to move down to Miami. And that's when they started right then. They had acquired Park Place, had acquired Caesars, and they needed to fill some spots in their branch offices. I wound up in Miami. I wound up in Atlanta. And then I wound up in 2001 at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. I guess I did a good job as a player development guy, and I'm really lucky for that. And as we talked about earlier, I think it's because of the courage that my father showed me, but the discipline that my mother showed me to never give up, but also to be courageous in putting yourself out there and not being afraid to say, hey, I'm here for you. There's nothing the matter with that, right? And I think that that's a really it all culminated well for me is the right way to put it. And
so Caesars was what, early 2000?
Caesars Palace was 2002. So I moved
Tell
from
us
Atlanta.
A little bit of what it was like back then. Paint a picture for us of the way it was. It was completely different.
Sure. There's a fellow named John Groom when I first started that was the president of Caesars Palace. Eventually it was Mark Giuliano. It was an amazing time. There were a lot of things happening. Wally Barr, as you said, Mr. Goldberg had passed away since then. At that point, but Wally Barr and Mark Giuliano were putting together, and I'm sure, I imagine John Groom had something to do with this as well, but, they were building the Coliseum, and they were changing the food and beverage programming, and they were going to do this amazing thing where Celine Dion was going to come, 100 nights a year, and it was just kind of unfathomable to me. And I remember being there opening.
Wow, that was the beginning of Celine Dion. Wow, amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I remember opening night at Bradley Ogden and seeing the celebrities there and people that had attended opening night and just being as in awe of the place as the guests were. And really feeling grateful for where I was and just enjoying every minute of it. And I spent the next 8 years of my career there. They opened Pure Nightclub. Boy, I really liked Pure Nightclub at the time. They had Cascada, which they still do. It was just a special place to be. It still is. It's Caesars Palace. It's got to be the most iconic casino in the industry, if not at least one of them, right? And it ever evolves and never stands still and continues to change who it is with the times. I just thought it was just a really, really amazing place to be. I'm still grateful for that time in my career.
You know, when we say, Celine Dion, the Coliseum, the Forum and all that stuff there that it's commonplace. Put it into perspective on how grandiose of an idea that was to do something like that. Because that had never been done before.
No. And it was
really, it's commonplace now, right? But I mean, back then, nobody had ever even attempted anything like that.
No, what I think was the most incredible part about it was that it was not going to be one of these 20,000-seat arenas in which a superstar like Celine Dion was going to come play these multiple week, multiple month engagements. But it was a small, super high quality as far as the experience and the audio goes, right? The sound, and it was going to be built for her. The stage was going to be built with the the grate, and it was just going to be customized for the entire show in a way that you wouldn't do for a city-to-city tour. The idea behind people were going to come over and over, and new people were going to be acquired year after year as loyal customers to the enterprise. Looking back at it, as you're putting it, Tino, it sounds so far-fetched, but it was a giant leap of faith, and somebody had a really, really huge level of confidence in the idea that had never been done before. So somebody was a groundbreaker. I imagine it was Wally Barr. I imagine it was partly other people that maybe shared that vision. But it was visionary at the time, and it was an evolution from other evolutions that had happened around Las Vegas. Because you certainly can't say that the Bellagio wasn't an incredible leap of faith, and you can't say that the Mirage certainly wasn't an incredible leap of faith. But to do that and add those amenities to Caesar's Palace was an incredible leap of faith. We knew that building a casino in Las Vegas was going to work, but we didn't know that building a $100 million theater that had, I think, roughly 3,500 seats, was going to garner such revenue and mean so much to the industry. So it was pretty impressive, and it was, like you said, it was groundbreaking.
Yeah, it's interesting too to note that part of Celine Dion's deal was that they had the replicator house that she lived in. So they actually replicated her entire home in Las Vegas. I was part of her deal.
You were?
Interesting stuff. Yeah.
Tell me more about that, Tino. I didn't know that fact.
Yeah. It was part of her deal. She said, if you want, I'll do it, but you have to build my home exactly the way I have it here. I think she's Canadian, like I'm Canadian too, from Montreal. And so they just basically got the same architect to build the house in Vegas exactly the same way as she had it in Montreal, with all the same furniture, all the same everything. So, yeah, interesting stuff.
That's amazing.
Pretty, like you said, pretty remarkable. So what did you do after Park Place?
So I guess in 2010, priorities evolve, I found myself wanting to, be not necessarily a doer of grabbing casino business or driving casino business to customer, but I wanted to teach people how to do it because I felt like that was something that was more of a calling for me, if you will. I had so many people from throughout my career that would come into my office and ask me how to call a customer and how to drive business and how to do it this way and how have I done what I've done. And I realized maybe there's something there for me in which I could teach people. I could teach people how to do it. And I realized that I wanted to move into some more leadership roles. So I was really lucky, I was asked to join the team at the Atlantis in Paradise Island, where I could take on more of a lead-by-example role. I wasn't a leader. I didn't capture any kind of management role. But I was asked to get there, and I guess there was some management and philosophical changes going on, and we were able to I was able to get in there and take a year doing what I did at Caesars, at the Atlantis, picking up the phone all the time, creating some new blackjack tournaments. We did that a couple times. I thought that was pretty impactful. And that was a really kind of meaningful time for me as well, because I realized a little bit more about what leadership was about, which is just that, giving back and kind of being of service to the people around you and the people that maybe report up to you, and how to lead them and show them, the best practices that have worked for you, or for me in that case. And although I didn't lead anybody by definition, I felt like I had an impactful role there that year. After that, I was lucky enough to be asked to join the team at the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas about a year into operations, which was, it was the most important time in my career, I think, where I joined the team. I was over the independent agent program, the strategic partnership program, where we were kind of creating a network of casinos that could refer business to us, because maybe they didn't have properties to send business to. Not everybody has casinos in Atlantic City and Biloxi, Mississippi, or Chicagoland that could send to the mothership in Las Vegas. And it gives those properties some competitive parity in their markets, and is meaningful to a property like the Cosmopolitan. Did the very best we could with it. I think it was really helpful in driving database signups, which, as you know, and when the Cosmopolitan opened, it didn't have a database. So spent a couple years doing that, as well as helping along the independent agent program. And then eventually was promoted to vice president of casino marketing, and just another great experience. I left after Deutsche Bank sold to Blackstone, and have watched that property just continue to do amazing things. I love what they've done with the sports book. I love what they've done with separating out the high-end slots and table areas, and I just think it's an incredible property. I still watch that property and just root for them, and think the things that they've done there are amazing. It's pretty incredible. Took a year off after my time at the Cosmopolitan, and remembered what happened over the past 20 some years, and was then approached by the folks in London to join the team there, and then 4 years later, here I am talking to you.
I love it. Should we take some calls?
I would love it.
Okay, great. Fantastic interview. This is Tino Magnetta. Do you have any questions for Casey?
Hey, Casey Cohen. This is Colleen Birch.
Hi, Miss Birch. How are you?
Hi. I love your compliment. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I miss working with you. I'll tell the world
that.
Thank
you. I miss working with you, and it's heartfelt.
Oh, my goodness. So I've got a trip, as you know, in May, so I can't wait to experience the Hippodrome in person. I think what I'm most curious about is there an attempt to replicate a Vegas-type feel and experience, or does the UK kind of just own what gaming and what integrated resorts is over there? Like, what can I expect?
Thank you. Obviously, we're uniquely British, and Simon is cautious that when he comes over for things like G2E and comes to look at what we're doing here in the States, he takes it from the mindset of how am I going to use these best practices and continue to create a uniquely British experience. So, I think you'll see some interesting things that are familiar to you. You'd certainly see a compelling loyalty club. and an interesting casino floor that is lively and very approachable, and you know, dealers that ask how you're doing today. But what you can expect, I think, that might be a little different are things that are uniquely British, like a coat check, you know, smoking terraces, which I know are happening in other markets around the country. But and at the same time, you'll see it in a theater environment. So it's just an old big theater. So the feel of the environment still feels like that theater when you stop and look at where you are, as opposed to being this massive open space that is designed to feel kind of mammoth, if you will. It's got a very cozy feel to it. And I think that is what goes kind of gives that nod to some of the smaller casinos that are pre-2005 Gaming Act British centric. So when you're over there and you're standing on the middle of the casino floor and you look up, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. You'll see you'll see the stage, you'll see the balcony, you'll go have dinner at the Heliot, and you'll start to put the pieces together. I think it's really about the environment more than anything else. And of course, you will remember that you're in Vegas, or that it has some thoughts of Vegas, because we took on Magic Mike about 2 years ago. So you can always do that as well.
Oh. Well, thanks. I've enjoyed listening to your story. You know, I was going to ask you about the Eagles and the Seahawks game. We probably should have had a bet, but or two bets maybe this season. You would have owed me two dinners.
I considered both times reaching out to you, but I'm a smart Eagles fan.
Yeah, and my Hawks lost to Green Bay, so now I'm rooting for the Pack. Have a great night.
Thank you so much, Colleen.
Thank you, Colleen.
Have a great night.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. She's great. She's really, really cool.
Amazing. Yep.
Yeah, she is. All
right,
she won't
let me pile it on too much, but yes, she's amazing.
No, she won't. This is Tino Magnani. Do you have a question for Casey?
Aloha. How's it going?
There you are. We tried again, and here we are. This is Tino Magnani. Do you have a question for Casey?
Casey, Michael Kaahanui, always a pleasure to hear the story, sir.
Hello, Michael Kaahanui. How are you, buddy?
Hey, Mike. Good, how are you, bud? Good to hear
I'm
you. Happy
good.
New Year. Good, buddy.
You guys as well. Hey, you know,
yeah.
Casey, you've had a broad career, brother, and certainly I know filled with great stories, but you know, because you've lived in so many regions and so many different markets, you know, I kind of get the feeling that maybe in each one you've taken a little something along the way from each. Like you learned something in Vegas and something during your time in Atlantic City for sure. But are there anything that, you know, you distinctly remember in each of those markets that, man, I picked up this little tidbit that I've always carried with me since then?
Of course, because whether I was in a different market or not, you learn and evolve as a person, you know, in each experience you have, hopefully in each year that you live. But you know, the truth is, I would say that, you know, in Atlantic City, I learned about the technical skills of the industry, understanding some of the things there. I took a lot of that away. I think when I run up to, you know, this decade in Las Vegas and even the previous one, I learned that the experience matters for the guest. At the same time, spending time with, you know, when I would say this, when Caesars acquire or when Harrah's acquired Caesars, I learned a lot more about understanding our customers' wants and needs and desires through data rather than just my own anecdotal information that I was compiling in my brain, and that there's value to both. So I'm not sure if it's necessarily about a place as it may have been about people. And so maybe that's the great takeaway from that question, is that when it all comes down to it, the relationships that we have in this industry, each one of them has a certain level of importance, and you're going to gain something from each and every relationship that you have. I mean, you and I have known each other since Atlantic City, and I admire what you do, and I've seen you go from Atlantic City to California, and now I think you're in the Midwest somewhere, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I am. I'm in Toledo, Ohio. Loving it here at Hollywood Casino.
I love it.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, each time it's been about the people. I learn more and more from that than I do necessarily from watching what happens to the bricks of the buildings. There's nothing that can replace learning from others.
That's a good kind of point, and great to my next question, if you don't mind, which is, you know, I got to imagine you've had some great mentors along the way. Is there anybody that, you know, that you'd want to kind of call out now?
Let's see, where do I start? So, yes, I mean, there's so many that I, you know, right? So my mother, my father, Tony Ashman at the Atlantic City Hilton, DJ Cott, John Unwin, and then other people that were not necessarily higher than me in the chain of command. I learned so much from some of the host staff at the Cosmopolitan, I got to tell you, because they challenged me every day. People like Michael Markin would challenge me all the time to make sure that I was being the best I could be. So I think of those people as mentors as well. You, Mike, I mean, there's things that we've learned from each other when we see each other at conferences and just remember each other and you know, always just catch up. To me, those experiences or those exchanges are just as valuable. So, of course, there's many people that had much more technical experience than I did throughout my career. But what I always remember, too, is that the people around me have given me back a lot. Here's a quick story that you just reminded me of. There was a guy that outside the Coliseum, outside the restroom at the Coliseum, he's a really nice man. He was the shoeshine guy, and I would go down and I would ask him how he is, and he would say, I'm doing good. And then I would say, and how's your family? And he would say, I'm the worst off. And what he meant by that is that everybody else is doing better than me, and that makes me happy. And that level of selflessness that he had is something that I try to always take with me. I don't know that I've always done a good job at it, and we're reminded of who we want to be in life all the time. And I think that you can look at those people as mentors as well. And, you know, he reminded me of that when I worked at there's a lot.
Oh, no,
that's great
story. Yeah.
Thank you.
Love Mike, it. Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate the questions.
Yeah, Mike, well, Happy New Year.
Have a good one. Happy New Year to you, brother.
Okay, take care, buddy. And by the way, congratulations, you just got married.
I did. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, wow.
Congratulations. I'm very happy.
That's
thank
great,
so
Mike.
Much.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. You
okay.
Guys have a good night. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye. Hello, this is Tino Magnani. Do you have a question for Casey?
No, it's just Colleen. I called in on my phone. Did I fool you?
Yeah.
New number.
Yes, you did.
I mean, I can talk some more.
Do you have another question? Sure. Yeah, why not?
Well,
go ahead.
Why don't I tell your audience that I did not just get married. How about we start there?
That's good.
Why don't I'm just sure use your forum to see if there's any nice single men out there that are worth it. I'm just kidding. Put me back on mute.
Okay. Have a good night.
Okay,
oh, that was hilarious. Oh, my God. Oh, that was hilarious. Oh, she's so funny.
You could put this one down on the that'll
yeah,
be down
on the
funny reel
on the bloopers. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, this is a great show. I'm having fun.
Tino
Magnani. You have a question for Casey.
Hey Tino, it's Kane Myers from DraftKings. How are you?
Hey, how are you, Kane?
I'm doing good. Congrats on your 175th show.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. We're enjoying every minute, as you can see.
Yeah, Casey, great to hear the story. Fantastic history lesson.
Thank you, and I love your product. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you, thank you. I got a question for you.
Okay.
So as we, as DraftKings has expanded across the U.S., we're influenced by, of course, some of the U.K.'s policies and procedures with regards to responsible gaming. It seems like they're cracking down a little bit harder in the UK, which is affecting us here domestically. Do you see that much, and how does it affect you as a marketer?
As in the bricks and mortar world, you're asking in the UK.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sure. It is something that when I started at the Hippodrome, I was fully brought up to speed about that. That social responsibility is paramount over and above all else, and taking care of the customer and ensuring the customer is safe. Whatever by yes, the definitions of that are broad, but it's kind of like you know it when you see it. And then GDPR, you know, coming into play, I'm sure has affected the way you do business there as well. But certainly it's not something that we're protected from. It's pretty interesting. There's some obviously, you know, probably wouldn't be right to tell the stories here, but there's certainly stories that, you know, we've had to make sure that we were adhering to every regulation or view that the regulator took in many of the actions that we decided upon, whether it's, you know, can we let somebody under 18 come up to the restaurant as an example? The answer is no. 18 is the gambling age in the UK. But in the States, you could stroll on in, and if you know you're under 21 and go to the restaurant, but people can't even cross the threshold if they're not over 18. I think that's a pretty broad and basic example, but yeah, the answer is from the bricks and mortar side, we certainly have a pretty formidable compliance department, and the marketing that we do, has to adhere to a certain set of standards, whether it's around the content, or whether it's around the calls to action, and obviously, finally, it's got to have the various be gamble aware and be drink aware disclaimers on it as well.
Good
yep.
stuff. Appreciate it. And I was going to follow it up with a much more fun question. What's your best Vegas story?
Tino, can you give him my phone number so that we could talk about that one offline?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know better.
Tino, thanks a lot for calling in. I really appreciate it.
Really nice to meet you, man. Thank you.
All right, take care, buddy. Bye. Casey, great show, man. I really appreciate you coming on. And then maybe we should do a show with you and Colleen. I'd really love that.
Yeah, no, sure. We could actually do like where me and you are the host, and we do like a match game or something.
Yeah, something like that. We'll figure it out. Hey, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I had a great time. It's a great way to kick off the new year, and good luck on all your new endeavors.
Thank you so much, and always good to talk with you.
Okay, we'll talk soon.
Bye, Tino. Take care.
You take care. What a great guy. He's fantastic. Knows a lot about a lot of different things, and he's just well-versed. It's interesting, the stuff that's going on in London. Remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You have to just have time to listen. Have a good night. We'll see you next time.